So every other year, the Institute of Biology gives out the Lacassagne Award. And this year, on a proposal by Jean-Louis Mandel, it will go to Hélène Puciot for her work on Friedreich ataxia. So she has worked on this disease for the past 15 years at last, covering many, many aspects of genetics, of course, but also cell biology, biochemistry, and even more recently, experimental therapeutics that have allowed her to demonstrate the essential role of the loss of the gene causing this disease, frataxin, in the assembly of iron-sulfur centers in mitochondria, resulting in cell death, and more recently to develop gene therapy approaches, models of this disease. So after, as we say, a very short discussion among the professors, this award is happily, reasonably short, we'll go to Hélène with our greatest.
Okay, well, I'd like to, I guess, thank Jean-Louis Mandel, who's not here, for for suggesting me, but I would like to thank all of you for, after a short or long discussion, accepting his proposition. And I'd like to thank Hugues for the kind introduction, and all of you for this very, very nice day, which I very varied, a lot of variation in the topics, but I found very interesting. So today what I'm going to try to do a little bit is give you some of the more recent work that we've been doing on Friedreich ataxia and trying to understand both the physiopathology of the disease, but also going towards more therapeutic approaches. So Friedreich ataxia is the most common recessive ataxia. So ataxia is loss of coordination of movement. It affects 1 in 30,000 people in the Caucasian population. It's a progressive mixed spinocerebral and sensory ataxia. So the sensory ataxia is the loss of information coming from the position of the body, and the spinocerebellum is actually all the efferent information going to the cerebellum. In addition to this primary neurodegenerative disorder, there's also a primary hypertrophic cardiomyopathy associated with the disease, and actually it's the most common cause of death in patients with more than 60% of the patient dying before the age of 25 of cardiomyopathy. And in addition, there's also an increased incidence in diabetes, about 20% in patients. So in terms of the mutation, it's a very particular mutation that was identified by Michel Koenig and Jean-Louis Mandel in 1996. It's one of the triplet repeat mutation, but it's a GAA expansion mutation, which is found in the intron of the gene, so it's not non-coding. And in FA patients, the triplet repeat mutation raises from between 100 to 1,000, and this leads to what we now know as a heterochromatization of the locus, which leading to transcriptional silencing and loss of frataxin. What's important to understand is that all FA patients have at least some residual frataxin, which is normal, with no mutation within the coding sequence. And this is thought to be between 5 and 10% of residual frataxin. This is what you can see here on a Western blot analysis, either in cerebral cortex or in cerebellar cortex from two patients or a control. You see this very low level of frataxin in these patients. So in terms of the physiopathology, what do we know about this absence of frataxin? It's from a very, very early on after the identification of the gene, and actually some of it before the identification of the gene, there were several common things that were known in terms of the physiopathology. There's iron accumulation within the cardiomyocytes. So you can see here the blue pearl staining, which is iron accumulation within the cardiomyocytes. Very early on, right after the gene identification, the team of Pierre-Justin and Arnold Munich, actually at Necker, had found out there was a specific deficit in iron sulfur cluster enzyme. These are enzymes that are important for the respiratory chain of the mitochondria and also the Krebs cycle, such as complex 1 and 2, 3 of the respiratory chain and aconitase. And there was also some thoughts or some markers of increased sensitive to oxidative stress or markers of oxidative stress in the urine and in blood. And so this led for a long time to this idea that frataxin deficiency led to this vicious circle where iron accumulation, for example, could lead to oxidative stress to Fenton's reaction and lead to iron cluster deficit, which these enzymes are very sensitive to oxidative stress, which would further dysregulate iron and lead to iron accumulation. And so this has been an important paradigm within the disease, and actually a lot of the therapeutic approaches at first were trying to look at these different parts, and particularly antioxidants to combat the oxidative stress and iron chelators to combat the iron accumulation. I'll come back to this during my talk. So what do we know about frataxin? Actually a lot of work has been done since the identification in 1996. Nothing was known about the sequence when it was identified, except that it was highly conserved from the gram-negative bacteria all the way to humans. It's a ubiquitously expressed mitochondrial protein. It's highly conserved, as I said. In terms of the structure, it has this unusual or unique fold, which is unique to only the frataxin gene family, with this beta sheets on this side and these alpha helix. It was shown very, very rapidly after the identification that it was actually able to bind iron along the acidic ridge of the alpha helix there. So the exact function of frataxin, although was unclear for many and very controllable for many years, we knew it was very closely linked to iron homeostasis and mitochondrial iron homeostasis since the beginning. And so, for example, here's an old scheme of the function or the various function that frataxin was involved with. So iron is actually very important within the mitochondria. So frataxin was proposed to be involved in iron storage, proposed to be involved as an iron donor for heme biosynthesis, or as an iron donor for iron sulfur cluster biosynthesis, or even in repair. So the work of many different labs, including my lab, has along the years been able to identify that the primary function of frataxin is actually in iron sulfur cluster biosynthesis. So what are iron sulfur cluster? Very quickly, these are very redox active cofactors. They're actually very anxious cofactors. And we heard this morning, actually, that maybe some of the membranes were before the lipids, maybe iron sulfur were there for the membranes. But in the mammalian system or the eukaryotic system, they're important for electron transport, enzyme catalysis, gene regulation, and actually every important cellular pathway that you look into the mammalian system or the eukaryotic system, there's an iron sulfur cluster protein in it. The common iron sulfur cluster cofactors that you can find in nature. And to actually make these, it's a very complex biosynthesis process that involves over 20 proteins within the mitochondria. And then there's actually a whole relay, again, then in the cytosol to continue making the iron sulfur clusters for the cytosol and the nucleus. So what we know, and this is a very schematic and picture of just the de novo, so the initial step of iron sulfur cluster protein. What we know now is that iron sulfur cluster protein happens on this de novo complex in which there's a cysteine disulfurase, NFS1, which brings in the sulfur. And there's a scaffold protein, ISQ, which is here in blue, and that's where the iron sulfur cluster will be built upon. And we now know that frataxin is involved in regulating the cluster assembly on ISQ by allowing the activation of the cysteine disulfurase in order to get the sulfur and at the same time allowing iron entry into the complex. Once the iron sulfur cluster is built on ISQ, then it's moved on to a whole series of chaperones to the apoproteins within the mitochondria, or something is built outside of the mitochondria from this de novo biosynthesis machinery for all the iron sulfur cluster outside the mitochondria, which are the cytosolic and nuclear. So it is clear now that frataxin is involved in the regulation of this iron sulfur cluster protein biosynthesis. So the approach that we've been taking in a lab to try to understand the physiopathology and to understand iron sulfur cluster or Friedreich ataxia is to generate cellular and mouse models. But in parallel, we also, as I just mentioned, worked a lot on trying to understand the protein function through biochemical approaches. And then the biggest strength of the lab is using the mouse model to try to understand the physiological mechanism involved, and then with always the end thought of going towards a therapeutic approach. And so over the years, we generated many different mouse models for Friedreich's ataxia. So originally we did a constitutive knockout, and that was embryonic lethal at 6.5 embryonic day. And so then we moved towards a conditional knockout. So these are organ-specific deletion of frataxin. This is using the Cre-Lox system, in which if we have LOXP sites around the exons here in exon 4 of the frataxin gene, and then we can express under tissue-specific promoter or Cre the Cre recombinase, and then it will actually delete in between the two LOXP sites, leading to a tissue-specific deletion of frataxin. So these are models that are much more severe than the humans. So humans, remember, have this GAA expansion, which leads to residual amount of frataxin all throughout the body. Here, we're deleting specifically for, or completely frataxin in specific cell types. So there are models. They're not perfect models, but they're good models to understand some of the effect, but they're more severe models also, and this is to keep in mind. And so we've generated, as you can see here, a variety of models, whether they've been cardiac models or neuronal models of the disease, to try to dissect the physiopathological pathway. And without going through all the different models that we've done, a very brief overview of what they enable us to do. And so most of these models actually have reproduced most of the important pathophysiological and biochemical features of Friedreich's ataxia. So, for example, the cardiac model develops a progressive cardiomyopathy. They have a deficient activity in the iron sulfur cluster protein, and this is actually both in the respiratory chain, but also in the aconitase, as was shown in humans, but also in other iron sulfur cluster proteins. They have mitochondrial iron accumulation. You can see here this dark accumulation of mitochondria of iron within the mitochondria that's actually not very healthy. The neuronal model have a progressive mixed cerebral and sensory ataxia with a progressive loss of proprioception. And so these models have been extremely good at demonstrating the early, what are the early pathways involved in the disease. And at the same time as we were working on the biochemical approach to understand the function of frataxin, this clearly led us to the fact that the early primary pathophysiological event of the loss of frataxin was iron sulfur cluster deficit, and that the iron homeostasis dysregulation came further on, and that if there is oxidative stress or cell death happens after all these events. So there was first an iron sulfur cluster biosynthesis dysfunction, the mitochondrial dysfunction, iron accumulation leading to cell death. And so this is, I guess, a simplified schematic on what we believe now happens in the absence of frataxin. But one of the questions that actually, so this is important for therapeutic consequences if we want to think about therapeutic. And I said that the earliest therapeutic approach actually were antioxidants very early on, actually a year or two after the gene was identified. And so you can see that antioxidants are actually very far down in terms of where they are in the scheme of the pathophysiology. So there's been a lot of antioxidant strategies, a lot of strategies that are around either iron chelation or increasing mitochondrial biogenesis and function. And more recently, there's been a lot of efforts towards trying to upregulate frataxin either by modulating the epigenetic environment by using hashtag inhibitors, or by, for example, protein or gene therapy. So today I want to talk about two approaches or two studies that we've done in the lab that enables us to kind of address a little bit these therapeutic approach. The first question that we wanted to raise in the lab is trying to understand really the source of iron, the iron accumulation, and what was the consequence of this iron accumulation. And this was really important because in our animal models, we had no sign of oxidative damage. And so we were really wondering whether this iron overload really led to Fenton's reaction. And this was important in terms of iron chelators, if this iron overload was toxic or not, whether we should or not use iron chelators. And so the way we approached this is actually using the mouse to approach this. And so really the question we were asking is, we knew that iron accumulation occurred, but we're wondering whether this actually led to oxidative stress, whether this was actually a toxicity effect, whether this contributed to mitochondrial dysfunction or even iron sulfur cluster deficit, and how that was related to the pathophysiology of the disease. And so the hypothesis that we had was the fact that there was probably the iron regulatory proteins involved. And why the iron regulatory proteins? So there's two iron regulatory proteins. There are RP1 and RP2. RP1 actually exists in two states in the cell. when their cells is plenished with iron, and actually when there's making iron sulfur cluster, it exists as a cytosolic aconitase. We don't know what the activity of the cytosolic aconitase is, but this is the form it exists in. So actually, in most of the time throughout the day of the body, whether it's a human or the mouse, it actually exists as a cytosolic aconitase. And when there is a deficiency in iron or a deficiency in iron sulfur cluster protein, it goes into this IRP1 form. And this IRP1, like IRP2, are able to find these IRE elements. So these stem looped structures are found on mRNAs. And they will have an action on the whole cellular iron homeostasis. And so, for example, when they bind to a stem loop that is in the 3' end of the gene, that will lead to stabilization of the mRNA and therefore increase translation of this of the gene encoding. And this is actually what happens on important genes that are implicated in cellular iron import, and particularly, for example, the transferrin receptor 1 receptor has an IRE on its 3' end. On the other hand, if you have an IRE on its 5' and the 5' end of the mRNA, this will actually, with IRP1 or IRP2 binding to this IRE, this will block the translation, and so then will actually lead to less expression of the gene involved. And actually here, this is the case for cellular iron storage, where you'll have less expression of ferritin. So if you have less iron, you will be in an IRP1 or IRP2 conformation, and so you will go into cellular import of iron and decreasing iron storage, which will then replenish the iron within the cell, and then once it's replenished within the cell, IRP2 will be degraded in an iron-dependent proteasomal degradation pathway, and IRP1 will go back into an iron sulfur cluster protein, so the cytosolic aconitase. And so our hypothesis was that this might be involved in the iron accumulation. So the first thing we did is we generated liver-specific knockout for frataxin. So why liver? Because the liver is not really affected, or we don't think it's affected, although it might be subacutely affected in patients. But liver is an important area for iron homeostasis. And so we see when we delete frataxin in the liver, the first effect is an iron sulfur cluster deficit. Here you can see SDH as a mitochondrial example, or for example, NTH1 as a nuclear example. And then very quickly, the liver, the mass actually goes through liver failure with lipid accumulation, a drastic here mitochondrial dysfunction, and a drastic mitochondrial iron accumulation, as you can see here by 4 weeks of age. And as I explained to you before, in the absence of iron sulfur cluster proteins, IRP1 becomes an IRE binding IRE binding elements, and using an EMSA assay where we have an IRE probe that is radio labeled, you can see that we have an activation of the IRP1 activity at 14 days of age in the mutant animals compared to the control. So, as I said, our hypothesis was that maybe IRP1 was responsible for this massive iron accumulation, and so we generated double IRP1 frataxin knockout. Just to know that IRP1 knockout have no phenotype at all in the normal condition in the laboratory. And so the first thing that we saw when we generated double knockouts is that you can see here the double knockout in pink have actually a highly reduced lifespan compared to the single knockout animals. So Alain actually did a lot of experiments at 23 days of age, so right before the rapid loss of these animals. And so what the first thing he noticed is that at 23 days of age, if he looked at markers of liver dysfunction, you can see here in a single knockout versus a double knockout, the markers of liver dysfunction here as ALAT is actually, they're highly increased. So really showing that the liver function is more affected in the absence of RP1, which fits actually with the very reduced lifespan. He then looked by different means, and here I'm showing you by electron microscopy the mitochondrial function. So he can see that here are mitochondria. So while the mitochondria at 23 days in the single knockout is relatively normal, in a double knockout they're extremely abnormal. They're very enlarged and they've lost their central crystra. So IRP1 sustains the mitochondrial function in frataxin deficiency. We then looked at iron homeostasis. And so here I just reminded you what I showed you earlier. And so just so you say, when we go into an IRP1, we have an increase in, we should have an increase in transferrin receptor 1. And so you can see here in the absence of frataxin, we have this increase in transferrin receptor 1 and a decrease in the cellular iron storage protein ferritin L. And in our double knockout, you can see that we are losing this increase. So we still have some. So there's still a second mechanism to sustain iron still in the cell or in the cell, but it's very much decreased, as you can see here, compared to the single knockout. So IRP1 sustained iron import, and then when we looked at iron content, mitochondrial iron content, you can see actually that in the absence of IRP1 we have less mitochondrial content. And this is at 23 days of age, but I had shown you that the iron content was increasing for frataxin deficiency at more at 4 weeks of age. And so if we look at 28 days of age, here we see in single frataxin knockout, the higher amount of iron accumulation within the mitochondria, there is a massive decrease of this iron accumulation within the double knockout mice. So IRP1 contributes to mitochondrial iron accumulation for frataxin deficiency. So what is the conclusion of this study? So first of all, it enabled us to understand what are the molecular players in the iron accumulation. And so, as I just said, in the absence of frataxin, we have deficit in iron sulfur cluster biogenesis, which leads to an IRP1 activation, which increases the transferrin receptor 1, leading to increase in the iron import. I haven't shown you that today, but we've also shown that the mitoferrin 2 is involved in doing the mitochondrial iron import. And then this leads to accumulation of iron within the mitochondria. So, and clearly IRP1 is necessary to sustain that. But what we have also seen is that in the absence of IRP1, so when we prevent this iron accumulation or this iron import, it's actually very bad for the cell. And so we actually think that this also tells us that the use of iron chelators in therapeutic approach for FA should actually be considered with caution. And actually, there's been a lot of different clinical essays that have been stopped because iron chelators have been detrimental in FA patients. What about other tissues that are affected in FA? So we're currently trying to understand whether this also occurs in heart and neurons, because this, of course, are tissues that are affected also in FA patients. So as I said, so that was the first story I want to tell you, is this idea of how does iron accumulation and what's the role of iron. And so we think that it's actually this iron accumulation is a protective effect of wanting to try to get more iron in to try to sustain mitochondrial function and iron sulfur cluster biosynthesis. The second story I want to talk to you about is a more recent story which is the approach of gene therapy for Friedreich ataxia. And so why gene therapy? It's an autosomal recessive disease. It has a postnatal onset with a slow progression, so we believe this is a therapeutic window. There's a residual amount of frataxin expression in patients, so they're not going to get an immune response against us bring back frataxin. And frataxin is a small protein, so it fits in many of the viral vectors that are out there. And more importantly, we know that we probably don't need much frataxin protein in order to have a therapeutic effect. And this is what we know is, heterozygous carriers, first of all, 50% of frataxin have no disease. But we also have animal models that have been generating using the GEA expansion. And they have about 20% amount of frataxin, and an animal model with 20% of frataxin has no phenotype, even under stress, even under iron overload. So we actually think that we don't need much frataxin for it to be efficient. So we embarked on this adventure a few years ago, and so we used AAV vectors because we thought they presented several advantages for gene therapy. They're non-enveloped single-stranded DNA. There's over 14 different serotypes with different tropism. In particular, in the RNR interest, there's actually two serotypes, RH10 and AAV9, which are known to target the heart and the neurons, and in particular the dorsal ganglia, which are affected in FA. They transduce post-mitotic cells, which are the cells of interest in FA, and they show very low immuno and genotoxicity in vivo. So one of the disadvantages they have is that they have a very small cargo capacity, but frataxin is a very small gene, so this actually does not prevent or makes a problem for us. So what are the two target tissues that we want to target? As I said, the heart is of interest, and also the dorsal root ganglia here along the spinal cord, which are actually necessary for, or that harbor the sensory neurons. So we made a first proof of concept that gene therapy would be very useful for the cardiomyopathy associated with Friedreich's ataxia. This was an intravenous injection of an RH10 that expressed human frataxin and improved survival and growth, rapid normalization of the left ventricle function and remodeling, even in mouse that had that were in heart failure, so very, very advanced in their disease. And then actually with a very rapid rescue. And so this showed us that there was a large therapeutic window. And so since we've published this, it's actually advanced quite a bit. And I'm just going to give you just an update of the advance. It's been licensed to a pharma company. We've actually performed a dose response study, and we've been able to show, to my biggest surprise, that if we correct only 50% of the cardiac cells, that's enough to maintain normal cardiac function and to correct cardiac function. So that's very interesting to think that only 50% of cells can be corrected and you still have, or mouse at least still has, normal cardiac function. And so now the pharma is actually ongoing with toxicity studies on what would happen with overexpression of frataxin, and studies in large animals for delivery method, and we're testing the clinical vector. And so the hope here is that this pharma will bring this vector into first clinical trials in 2018. So that's their prediction. When it happens, I'll tell you that it's happening, because I think that predictions are very, very positive. So what I do want to talk to you about today is some of our unpublished work on what we've been doing. So that was a cardiac aspect. And so even though the cardiac aspect is important, because 60% of the patients die of the cardiomyopathy, the neuronal aspect of the disease is actually very important also in terms of quality of life for these patients. And so as I said, one of the primary neurons that is degenerating in these humans is the sensory neurons. And so these are the large proprioceptive neurons you can see here that are in the DRGs. This is actually a very small population of the neurons in the DRGs. You can see here in patients the absence of these large proprioceptive neurons. And these are the neurons that actually bring back the information from the position of your body towards your cerebellum and cerebral cortex. And so these is actually extremely important for the position and coordination of your movements. So to do that, we generate a new neuronal model in which we try to specifically deplete frataxin in these proprioceptive neurons. And actually, the parvalbumin cream mice actually has that capacity. You can see here a dorsal root ganglia where you can see expression of the cree here on the LAX-Z very early on, P8 already, in the large proprioceptive neurons of the dorsal root ganglia. And we actually do also get expression in the Purkinje cell layer of the cerebellum, but this is much later on at P40. So again, not a perfect model, but a good model, because the early part is really a sensory part. And so we've been doing a lot of different behavior tests with these animals. As you can hear on the notch bar, we look at them, their capacity of the mouse to walk on the notch bar. You can see the mutant animals over the time make more and more mistakes with the incapability of walking on this notch bar compared to wild-type animals. We can look at the string test, which evaluates much more of the peripheral coordination. And again, you can see it's less sensitive than the notch bar, so it only starts around 6.5 or 7 weeks of age, but again, we can see a progressive loss of coordination on this string test. And then we can actually do some electrophysiology to look at specifically the sensory wave. And so by stimulating the sciatic nerve, which is a mixed nerve, then we can record both the M wave, which is the motor wave directly, but then we can also record the H wave, which is a sensory wave, and it gives us really a good idea of what are the sensory wave or sensory neurons function or not. And so as you can see here, here's a motor wave, so there's no motor defect. But if we look at the sensory wave, we see that there's already at 4.5 weeks of age, there's a decrease in sensory wave, and this actually decreased to completely disappear by 10 weeks of age. And so this is a very specific sensory defect. And again, if we look at neuronal loss, and so here's just one of the counts, but there's many different other ways of counting. Here's if we count globally all the numbers of neurons per area in the dorsal ganglia, we get to see that we have a decrease of 14% about of neurons, and we now know that these actually correspond to the large proprioceptive neurons. And this occurs about 10.5 weeks of age. So of interest for the patients, even though there's a very strong dysfunction in the sensory neurons early on, the neurons are still there. And so that's actually important for correction, or if we want to come with correction. So we did some therapeutic approach using gene therapy. So we first started with presymptomatic. And so this is a very early treatment at 3.5 weeks of age. So although they do have a little phenotype, it's not a very strong phenotype. We treated at a very high dose of vector. This was a systemic administration using the AAV9 under with the frataxin, the human frataxin gene, under a strong ubiquitous promoter. And we followed the mice until 17.5 weeks of age. And so this is just to give you an idea. So here's a wild-type mice. So here's another one of the, this is a normal bar test. You can see wild-type mice has no problem walking on this test. Here's a mutant animal at 8 weeks, so you can actually notice that it's not doing as happy as the wild-type mice, and it's using its tail actually to balance itself, in addition to kind of hugging the bar. And here's a KO animal, mutant animal that was treated, so at 3.5 weeks of age, so this is 5 weeks after treatment, if I can get the video. And so actually notice, look at the tail, because the tail really shows you, it really doesn't need its tail to balance itself anymore. So you don't have to be a mouse clinician to know that this mouse is doing better than the other one. So again, we have different ways of measuring this. So if we go back on the crenellated bar test, what you can see is that here's when we treated the animals. Actually, they were already affected on the crenellated bar. And actually, 1 week after, you can see we correct them. And we actually maintain them correct for quite a while. They do develop a little bit of a problem when they actually start trembling. And remember I said that we are actually deleting frataxin also in the Purkinje cells later on. And we know that by IV injection, we actually don't cross completely the blood barrier, brain barrier. So that's actually makes sense. And so that's probably more of the Purkinje or the cerebellar phenotype or the probably a little bit of cortical phenotype coming up also. If we look at the string test, which strictly looks at the peripheral system, you can see here, this is when we treated, and again, it's less sensitive, so it's only around 7.5 weeks of age that we see something, but you see that we actually maintain them completely corrected all the way until 16.5 weeks of age. So this is a complete prevention of the of this phenotype. And then if we look at the EMG, so the sensory defect, so we can't actually do EMG before 4.5 weeks of age, and the mouse is too small. But so the first point is 1 week after injection. So you can see that the untreated animals already have a defect, where the treated animals are equivalent to wild type, and this is maintained. So we don't know if this is a correction or prevention, because we don't know what's happening before. But this is extremely encouraging, obviously. If we look at the neuronal loss in dorsal root ganglia, again, we also completely prevent the loss of dorsal root ganglia. And that actually correlates with all the other phenotype that we're seeing, that these mice seem to be completely corrected in terms of the sensory proprioceptive effect. And again, we can also go look at electron microscopy to see if we correct or if we prevent the degeneration that you see, the axonal degeneration that you can see. So here's in the sensory or in the sciatic nerve, the sensory neurons, some of them are myelinated, as you can see here, and some actually are in remake bundles. And in KO animals, you can see actually a lot of degeneration of some of the myelinated axons. You can see some, I don't know if you can see anything here, but there's abnormal mitochondria in these small These are the large myelinated axons, so these are the proprioceptive axon. And if we look actually the treated KO, there's actually no defect that we can see by electron microscopy. So it really looks like we've completely corrected completely these animals. So that's great. We have generated this new model. We've been able to prevent the onset of the disease. We're obviously characterizing these models, and I haven't had a chance to show you all the molecular markers that we have on trying to understand what's going on in these neurons and how they're degenerating, what are the pathways involved. This is clearly very exciting results. But patients, when they come, they already have a phenotype. So are we really interested in preventing, or are we interested in trying to correct? And so as we did for the cardiac part, we also went on and looked at gene therapy evaluation for correction, so at later time points. And so I'll start with the video, because the video is, so this is, it's post-symptomatic, so at 7.5 weeks of age. Here's a non-treated animal, so it's going to take time to get going, so it has a hard time going on there. So you can see that this untreated animal has actually really, really hard time going on that crenellated bar and doesn't really want to go. And when it goes, you see that it's making lots of mistakes. It's having a hard time coordinating. It's actually not going forward very much. And so what we did is we actually treated the mice at 7.5 weeks of age. We did two types of treatment on the same mice. Intravenous treatment with injection, so the same as we did before, but to try to correct the cerebellar phenotype that was affecting. We did some intracerebellar delivery, actually, with the cerebral right minor and striatum bilateral. So trying to cover as much as we could of the cerebellum and the cerebral phenotype. So here's a KO mice 1 week after treatment. So the same age as the other one. So although it's not completely normal, you can see that it's doing much better. And so this was extremely encouraging, obviously. So we continue, we have a big, large cohort of animals, so we analyze this cohort of animals. So here is on the notch bar test, the test that I just showed you. So here is before treatment, so you see that both cohorts of animals are affected, and at treatment, the untreated animals continue to progress and the loss of coordination, while the treated animals stop progressive. It kicks in and starts progressing a little bit. And again, I think this is the cerebellar phenotype. We see them actually trembling, and we're probably not completely correcting all of the cerebellar phenotype. If we looked at the string test, so again, we're looking strictly at the peripheral phenotype. You can see this is at time of treatment. So this is the measurement before treatment. So you see both cohorts are equally affected. 1 week after treatment, while the untreated animals have a hard time doing this test. The treated animals get corrected, so they can actually get their feet back up on the string test very quickly. And this is maintained all the way until 20 weeks of age. And then finally, if we looked at the sensory defect, so by EMG, and so this is really a functional effect. So here is prior to treatment. So you see, again, both cohorts are fully or nicely or very much affected on the sensory wave. Here is the intensity. After treatment, you can see the untreated animals actually collapse completely and have no sensory wave, where the treated animals actually get back more sensory wave and to be maintained as in wild-type animals. So it looks like when we treat at 7.5 weeks of age, we're able to actually reverse the sensory neuronal phenotype. So of course, that's extremely encouraging. And so now we're obviously continuing all this work. This is all ongoing work. We're trying to figure out also if the molecular pathways are corrected. So that's truly ongoing, because we're in the middle of it. And we're also trying to see how far we can go. So here we went at 7.5 weeks of age. So this is when we know we have no neuronal loss. We know the neuronal loss happens at 10.5 weeks of age. So right now we have a cohort of animals that are injected at 9.5 weeks of age to see if, yes or no, we can correct, if we can have partial correction of the phenotype. And obviously then we'll follow up with dose response studies and large animal studies with the hope of going towards humans afterwards. So with that, I'd like to thank the people involved in this work. This has been a very big team effort. So The work I presented on IRP1 is actually the work of Alain Martelly, who has now left the lab and is working at Pfizer in Boston on an FA gene therapy and pharmacological approach. So that's actually quite interesting in direct competition with us, but it's fine. I know he's well-trained, so I know they'll manage to do something. Morgan and Brahim have been working on the cardiac gene therapy approach and have been very good at doing this. Morgan is no longer with us, but Brahim is continuing working. He's the one who's been doing all the dose response. And then on the neuronal aspects, it's Charlene, Françoise, Laurence, and Nadège who've been pushing huge effort because this is work that actually started 3 years ago, so we've advanced quite fast on this. And I'd like to thank all my many collaborators of the years, the finance, and you for your attention.